This week, a recent 3,000-year-old inscription found in Israel. A name is produced. What is the history of this name? And what's its connection with Freemasonry? Then we'll hear from illustrious brother Stephen L. Harrison in an all-new Masonic Minute. We all hear that George Washington won the president unanimously. But is that factually correct? Steve Harrison puts it all on the line and will make us all a little better informed. All this and a little bit more in this episode of Whence Came You. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back to the show. This is episode number 505. Right away, I want to thank everybody out there who supports this show, whether you're a contributor, fellow, or producer, or even a legacy partner. You have brought so much to Masonic education by assisting us to be able to offer this podcast and everything else that we do to put out there for everybody interested in, you know, this philosophy of ages, Freemasonry, its kindred sciences, and we're offering it to everybody out there. And it's because you guys have allowed that to happen. In particular, you know, iTunes actually caps the number of episodes that it holds for you at 300. We have 500 episodes. That means 205 episodes previously are not available on iTunes. Where do people get those? Well, they get them via our RSS podcast page through Liberated Syndication, which is available if you find it on our website. You can click on that and check it out. But the point is that without your donations, those podcasts might not be available. Those 200-plus episodes would not be possible to offer everybody and to continue to make improvements and put the music to the episodes and do all of this awesome stuff. Without you all, it doesn't happen. And I gotta thank you for that. So whether you're assisting us that way, or maybe you're sharing the show with your friends, maybe you're liking the videos, subscribing on YouTube, turning on the notifications, all of those things assist us in so many ways, and we cannot thank you enough. So I want to thank you guys from the bottom of my heart, really. If you're out there and you're thinking, hey, wow, I've waited a long time, I've never contributed to this show, how can I help? Go to the Whence Came You podcast website, wcypodcast.com, click on support the show, and check it out. You could send us a dollar on a one-time gift. All of that just helps us out, and rest assured, you're assisting bringing Masonic education, a philosophy for the ages, as I've said, to the masses of the world. We have a massive consciousness shift, and we're trying to make things better, and that's the mission of Masonry, right? Leaving this place better than we came into it, and bettering yourself along the way. Well, this is how we're attempting to do it in our own way. In the news, I just want to say that we did go ahead and launch the Craftsman Journal and Pen. It's available on our website. We have just a few in stock left. We sold a bunch right away, so I want to thank everybody out there who picked them up. I just wanted to let you guys know that that is out if you're interested in it. Pictures are on the website. Check it out. That's under the shop. Anything you buy does go back and help out this program. I want to give a shout-out to Brother Jeff, who contacted me after last week's episode. And he actually has a great document that is put out from the Grand Lodge of Iowa. And it is a little booklet that helps improve interest and attendance. I'll put a link to this awesome document in the show notes. Please check it out, because if you are struggling with these kinds of issues, this document may help you out. So big thanks to Brother Jeff and the Grand Lodge of Iowa for allowing us to post this for our brothers out there who are having some issues here, or maybe are looking for some, you know, just additional assistance and thinking outside the box. Before we move on, I want to thank everybody who reached out and sent me notes of congratulations on some Masonic stuff recently. You guys really make me so happy, and just thank you so much for all of those congratulatory notes. This episode, a little bit shorter. I've got to go on vacation. I don't have a ton of time to edit this week, so I wanted to put this together for you and make it at least interesting, right? We always try to do that. We want to get you interested and digging into the mysteries of the world. So this week, I ran across a short blurb in Archaeology magazine about a 3,000-year-old inscription found in Israel. Now, first up, okay, 3,000 years old, bam, my interest is piqued. Then it's an inscription, okay, found in Israel, holy cow, that's pretty cool. Right, that has something to do with our fraternity a little bit, maybe a lot bit, right? And it's 3,000 years old. So this goes back to the time. And so let's check out this little blurb here, and then let's talk a little bit more after we finish. 3,000-year-old inscription found in Israel, published Tuesday, July 13, 2021. Kiryat Gab, Israel. According to a statement released by the Israel Ministry of Foreign Affairs, a fragment of an inscription thought to be related to the biblical work of Judges has been found at the site of Kirbat Ra'i, or Re'i, which is located in southern Israel, by a team of researchers from the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, the Israel Antiquities Authority, and the Macquarie University. The alphabetic script inscription, written in ink on a fragment of pottery jug, includes the name Jurabal, or Jurabal, and dates to about 1100 BC. In the biblical tradition, the name Jerubal is associated with the judge Gideon. The piece of pottery was found in a storage pit that had been lined with stones. The jug may have held oil, perfume, or medicine. Alphabetic inscriptions from this period have mostly been found in the Canaanite city of Tel Lachish in south-central Israel, which was destroyed about 1150 BC. The discovery of the inscription suggests that the use of the alphabet may have been preserved at Kirbat Ra'i after the fall of Tel Lachish. So interesting in and of itself, of course. You got to check out the picture, and we'll put a link back to that in the show notes. But what caught my eye for the Master Masons out there around the world is likely the name Jerubbaal. J-E-R-U-B-B-A-A-L. Now, the Jerub and that kind of thing is interesting. Baal, as in the god, B-A-A-L, maybe? So, this was pretty wild, and it got my mind spinning a little bit. When researching this name, I came across a short article here in MasonryToday.com, and it says the first two pillars. I'll put a link back in the show notes to this as well. It says the first two pillars. Today, in Masonic history, we present the first two pillars. Freemasons are familiar with the pillars of Solomon's Temple biblically. These are not the first two pillars mentioned. First, some backstory leading to the first two pillars. Genesis, in part, tells the story of Cain and Abel. Biblically, they are the first sons of Adam and Eve after they leave the Garden of Eden. Cain slew Abel, and Cain was cast out to never live in the sight of God again. After Cain's departure, Adam and Eve have another son, Seth. It is the offspring of Cain and Seth which leads us to the building of the first two pillars. Biblical scholars are somewhat undecided on this subject. In the first version of the creation of the two pillars, Seth's descendants, including Enoch and Lamech, led virtuous lives. It should be noted that Cain had descendants also named Enoch and Lamech. The descendants of Seth are credited with developing astronomy, the division of time into weeks, months, and years, both solar and lunar, and to have evolved Hebrew characters. They were warned by a prophecy of the end of the world. To protect the knowledge they developed, they inscribed the knowledge on two pillars. Both had identical knowledge in the hopes one or the other survived the destruction of the world. The first was made of brick, the other of stone. In the other version, it is the descendants of Cain, the children of Lamech, who actually are the ones who develop the knowledge and inscribe the information on the pillars. Lamech married two women. The first was Adah. Adah gave birth to Jubal and Jabal, or Jabal and Jubal. Jubal is said to have been the father of stringed instruments and pipes. Jabal was the father of, quote-unquote, those who live in tents and raise livestock. Lamech's second wife was Zillah. She gave birth to Tubal Cain, who forged all kinds of tools out of bronze and iron. Tubal Cain also had a sister, Naamah, sometimes Naamah, who is believed to have been the first person to undertake weaving. Again, the information is inscribed on the brick and the stone pillars when there is a prophecy of the destruction of the world. In both versions of the story, the mention of the destruction is not clear in the prophecy. It is either inundation, flooding or deluge, or conflagration, fire or burning. In both stories, the motivation for inscribing the information on the two pillars to survive inundation and conflagration. The concept of preserving knowledge later applied to the pillars of King Solomon's temple. Regardless of which antediluvian, before the biblical flood story is ascribed to, the original pillars were meant to safeguard the knowledge which had been accumulated prior to the destruction of the world, just as knowledge is believed to have been stored in the pillars of King Solomon's temple. All right, take a couple steps back. So, I've talked about the pillars in several episodes, but this always seems to crop back up and really gets my mind spinning. So if you listen to those episodes and then you just heard this one, you're like, geez Louise, Robert, get off the pillars. I won't do it. I love the idea of the pillars. I love the idea of hidden knowledge and storing it and keeping it around and preserving it. Because I also kind of believe in this idea that, you know, humankind has pinnacled a few times. So with this article, it is interesting to note that some of the characters are treated differently in different traditions and even in pop culture and movies. If you have seen the movie Noah starring Russell Crowe, you'll know that Tubal Cain is probably not a great dude. But is that accurate in the Tanakh, the Pentateuch, or other biblical traditions? I'm not entirely sure, and when I research that online, I get mixed stories. But interesting to note that the names Jubal and Jabal sound really familiar to that 3,000-year-old inscription, Jerubbaal. Now, likely this is a very common type of name around that area. Perhaps it even means the same name in a different dialect, but it was interesting nonetheless. My question for you in the Craftsman Plus around this topic is, what sort of quote-unquote fringe theory in Freemasonry do you have a quote-unquote guilty pleasure in believing? Or if you're like me, you have a giant poster in your office that says, I want to believe, just like the X-Files and Fox Mulder had. I want to believe some of this amazing, sensational things, but can we responsibly? I don't know. I'd love to hear your thoughts. Now, speaking of sensationalism, next up, let's hear from Stephen L. Harrison in this week's Masonic Minute.
Did you know George Washington was a Freemason? It's true. I'm a little surprised so many of you didn't know that. Anyway, even if you didn't know that, you probably know he was the first president of the United States, and history tells us he ran virtually unopposed in the election of 1788 to 1789. Well, the key word is, I guess, virtually. You see, the Constitution stipulated the presidency would go to the person getting the most electoral votes, and the vice presidency would go to the runner-up. So, the question is, if Washington was the unanimous winner of the election, how could there be a runner-up? And if there was a runner-up, just how did Washington get all the votes? And doesn't that mean he had an opponent in that election? And if your head isn't spinning by now, get this. Technically, you could say George Washington had 11 opponents in that race. 11. See, the key to this puzzle is the fact that each of the 69 electors back then got 2 votes. So the first 69 votes went to Washington, and he won a unanimous victory. Then the second set of 69 votes went to a variety of men, with the one garnering the most votes becoming vice president. So who were these guys? You can probably guess one of them was John Adams, who received 34 of the remaining 69 votes and became our first vice president, going on to become the second president. Robert Harrison, no relation that we know of, Washington's personal military secretary, received 6 votes. Also receiving 6 votes was John Rutledge, who became the second Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. John Milton, first Secretary of State of Georgia, received 2 votes, James Armstrong, a Georgia state representative, and Edward Telfair, governor of Georgia, both got a single vote. Georgia was well represented. So, Adams, Harrison, Rutledge, Milton, Armstrong, and Telfair account for six of the men receiving electoral votes. The remaining six, including Washington, half the field, were Freemasons. John Jay, first Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, received nine votes and came in a distant second to Adams for the vice presidency. His Masonic status is, in fact, somewhat vague, but it is likely he was a member. John Hancock, first signer of the Declaration of Independence and first governor of Massachusetts, received four votes. George Clinton, governor of New York and later vice president, got three votes. Samuel Huntington, second Grand Master of Ohio and also a governor of Ohio, received two votes. Finally, Benjamin Lincoln, ex officio Secretary of War during the American Revolution, got a single vote. There was not much of a campaign in that election. It was a foregone conclusion George Washington would win. It's likely each of the 11 also-rans we've talked about had his sights on the vice presidency. Also, although there were no political parties per se, most of the candidates were like-minded Federalists, favoring a strong federal government. Only Clinton and Telfair were anti-Federalists who not only opposed a strong federal government, but also opposed ratification of the Constitution. In addition to that, back then it was considered rather undignified for a gentleman to campaign for an office. Some might say that's the opposite of our situation today, where being undignified seems to be a requirement for public office. One wonders if the aversion to campaigning has something to do with the fact electioneering is frowned upon, if not outright banned, in many Masonic elections. Our nation's first election, with a president elected unanimously and votes left over for 11 runners-up. Interestingly, in the inconceivable scenario they would have been elected president, or maybe a bit more likely vice president, Harrison, Rutledge, Armstrong, and brother John Hancock would have died in office. For the Whence Came You podcast, this is Steve Harrison with the Masonic Minute.
All right, well, I don't know about you, but I certainly had no idea about this really interesting turn of events and a deeper look, really, into what actually happened in that first, quote-unquote, election. Unanimous except for the other stuff? pretty fantastic. I want to invite you all to check out the video for this, which is, of course, on our YouTube channel, but is also on Steve's YouTube channel, so subscribe to both, however you want to do that. We also have an entire playlist that's just called the Masonic Minute that you can pull up on the YouTube channel and hit go and let it play for the remainder of the evening if you're having a public night or something like that where folks are going to come out and maybe they hang out and they watch these. And you'll be surprised how many people could really get sucked into these stories because, you know, Steve brings great stories, but he also has this just innate ability to be a great storyteller. So just fantastic. Big thanks to Steve, as always, for bringing us these segments. They reinvigorate our interest in the history of the craft and all things that that kind of encompasses. I urge you to check out the Missouri Lodge of Research, where Steve has done so much work, published so many books. All of his books can be found, of course, through the bookstore on WCYpodcast.com as Amazon links that go back to them. And those are affiliate links, just so you all know. But it is a win-win-win. You get a book, Steve gets a sale, and the show gets a couple pennies from the sale. Doesn't affect the price at all. One of my favorite books, I always tell everybody, is Freemasons at Oak Island. It still is. I also really enjoy one of Steve's other works called Tales from the Craft, which is just another great book if you like these Masonic Minutes. Again, this was a short episode. I want to thank you all for joining me this week. I am heading out of town. I'm going 6 hours north with the family for a little family reunion that we have every year, except we didn't have it last year because everybody was shut down and trying to keep everybody healthy. And I hope you all are staying very healthy and doing our part to get back to normal, because we're almost there, right? I'm really hoping. So again, my thanks to everybody for liking the show, subscribing, and turning on notifications. Big thanks to our contributors, fellows, producers, and legacy partners for doing all the work and helping us out month after month with donations. You guys keep it all going and just make this happen. So thank you so much. So that's it. We'll talk to you all next week. Until then, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson. Take care.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.